On February 23, 2024, Peter M. Sandman gave a Zoom presentation to a Heterodox Academy conference on COVID and the Academy, What Have We Learned? His 31-minute presentation was entitled, What Goes Into an Expert's Expert Judgment Other Than That Expert's Expertise? With COVID examples. He covered 8 points, the first 4 at some length and the last 4 sketchily as he ran out of time. Dr. Sandman's more detailed notes for the presentation are available on his website, as are his slide set and a link to the Heterodox Academy's YouTube video of the presentation.
So let's give 2 hands together for Dr. Sandman.
Thank you. I'm hoping I can be heard. If I can't, I assume somebody will tell me.
We'll hear you loud and clear.
I am not live from Brooklyn. I am actually live from the Atlantic Ocean. I'm en route from Rio de Janeiro to Cape Town, South Africa. So I'm rocking and rolling on a ship at the moment. I'm not only the only person on this panel with no, who isn't in the room, I'm also the only person with no research to report. I'm going to be giving you impressions from a 50-year career as a risk communication consultant. What that means, being a risk communication consultant, is that I try to replicate in some audience the attitude toward the risk that experts are telling me, or my clients' experts are telling me, is most commensurate with the data. So if the experts say this is a serious risk, I try to get people more worried, more upset, more concerned. If the experts say it's a trivial risk, I try to calm people down. Given that I did that for 50 years, I spent an awful lot of time with experts, experts in various aspects of risk assessment. If you will, go to the next slide, please. Not neutral experts for the most part, experts that believed what my client wanted the public to believe. So I had a front row seat on what was behind my experts' expertise, what was behind their expert judgment other than their expert expertise. And that's what I really want to talk about today. What goes into an expert's expert judgment other than that expert's expertise? I'm going to give examples to the extent that time permits from COVID, but most of the points I'm going to be making are generic points. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm giving you anecdotal evidence, if you will. I'm going to talk about what I think I've learned in 50 years of working with experts, but I didn't do any research on those experts. Take that with whatever grain of salt you think is appropriate. One other introductory point. My comments today are going to be critical of the public health establishment and perhaps of experts in general. So I think it's important for me to say that I'm on their side. They're the good guys. But in large part because they're the good guys, and because they feel like the good guys, and because they feel like the public should damn well know they're the good guys, they tend to be resistant to overcoming the biases that I'm about to talk about. So they're the good guys, but they're not the best at keeping their expertise narrowly expert and unbiased. One further comment to the people running this event: I tend to run long, so I would be grateful if you would warn me when I've got about 3 minutes left. Don't send me a text because I won't see it. Just interrupt and say 3 minutes to go, and I'll skip the details and cut to a few bottom lines. Next slide, please. This is my first of 8 key points. Expert opinion is mostly secondhand opinion. outside of their narrow specialties, most experts know only the conclusions that the handful of real experts have promoted. Now, I think we know this if we think about it, but we don't usually think about it. A handful of people have studied some particular thing for decades, and they know it cold. They produce the literature. They read every study that they didn't actually write, and they read it carefully. Maybe they go back and look at the original data. But there's only a handful of them. Everybody else in the same field studied something else, some other subtopic for the last 20 or 30 years, and they are secondhand experts. They haven't produced the data. They haven't examined the data. At best, they've maybe read a few of the key articles in top journals. Often they've only read summaries of the literature, sometimes not even that. They just hear the scuttlebutt from their colleagues, so that they are distinctly secondhand experts, but of course they're nonetheless promoted as experts by their universities. I mean, the media get announcements saying Dr. Sandman is available for interviews as an expert on anything having to do with communication. And that certainly happened to me when I was a university professor. This is a process that works just fine when two specs are met. One, the real experts all agree, and two, the real experts are right. If the experts are wrong, of course, the secondhand experts are going to be the last to know it. But I think more importantly, if the experts disagree, a secondhand expert may not realize that that handful of real experts do not, in fact, have a consensus. Some of what happens is a secondhand expert knows pretty much what the experts in his or her narrow venue believe. So that, for example, if the real experts in the United States think that schools should be closed because of COVID, then secondhand experts think all experts believe that, and may not realize that over in Europe, the real experts are thinking that schools should be kept open. To give another example, if the real expert epidemiologists think that COVID is mostly droplets, and therefore social distancing is important and non-medical masks are likely to be useful, a secondhand expert, also an epidemiologist, may think that's what all real experts believe. But in fact, experts in other fields, respiratory protection, fluid dynamics, industrial hygiene, engineering, all those experts, as it turned out, were disinclined to think that COVID was mostly droplets. They thought COVID was mostly aerosols. And that led to very different recommendations. If it's aerosols, ventilation is a lot more important and social distancing is a lot less important. Masks are a lot less likely to work unless they're N95s. But if I'm a secondhand expert, I know what the experts in my country and in my discipline believe at best. And if the experts in my country and my discipline are also in disagreement, if there's no expertise even in that narrower area, I may not know that even. In short, knowledge, even expert knowledge, is a lot more communal than we normally realize. I think it's worth pointing out that we believe falsehoods for the same reasons we believe truths, because people we trust have told us to believe them. The dynamics of coming to believe something that's false and the dynamics of coming to believe something that's true are pretty much the same. In neither case are you relying on data. In both cases, you're relying on trust in people you believe are the experts. The last point I want to make about point one, which I think is important to bear in mind, is that human beings tend to lose track of this distinction between firsthand and secondhand knowledge. We absorb conclusions from sources we trust, and then we imagine that we know why those conclusions are valid. So when secondhand experts, which again, as most experts, when they tell us to trust the science, what they're really themselves trusting isn't the science, it's their secondhand impression of what they think is the consensus of a subset of real experts. So that's point number one. Next slide, please. Point number two, expert consensus is often not a genuine consensus, just a majority opinion. I think this is true for both firsthand and secondhand experts. And what happens is the minority opinions very often go underground, either that or they're ridiculed. Now, I don't want to overstate this point. Lots of scientific conclusions are unanimous or nearly unanimous. If they've been much studied, there may be virtually no expert disagreement. But what's interesting, I think, is what happens when there is expert disagreement. And I think what's going on there is a kind of a tipping point phenomenon. If the experts are 50-50, we're likely to know they don't agree. But at somewhere around 75 to 25, where it's 3-1 on one side versus, you know, the majority versus the minority tends to go silent, to go underground. So what happens? Experts with minority opinions have trouble getting evidence, right? They can't get grants. Their papers aren't published, or if they're published, they're not in as high stature journals. Experts who share those minority opinions but maybe aren't so aggressive, they see what's happening to the aggressive minority, and they see the handwriting on the wall, and they decide they'd better go into a different subfield where they're not in the minority. Those who don't see the handwriting on the wall and refuse to go silent may be ostracized in the faculty lounge, or they may be publicly disparaged, redefined as not really experts at all. In some cases, of course, they are, these outlier experts are deplatformed. If they don't deplatform themselves by going silent, I assume I do not have to tell a Heterodox Academy audience about the deplatforming of minority experts during COVID. Some of it engineered by government officials at NIH, CDC, the White House, and so forth. Some of it undertaken voluntarily by Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms. So if the real experts, the minority of real experts are going silent, then the secondhand experts get a misimpression. That 75-25 disagreement begins to look like a consensus. And of course, the pressures on the real experts are also exerted on the secondhand experts. The pressure not to be vocal with a minority opinion. So suppose, for example, you are a young assistant professor in a school of public health in the early months of the pandemic, and you've read probably at least a little bit about the Great Barrington Declaration. What you've read is not likely, I think, to motivate you to read further. It's profoundly unlikely to motivate you to mention the Great Barrington Declaration in a TV interview as an example of how the experts aren't all on the same page about whether lockdown is a good idea. So the secondhand experts get a misimpression of how much consensus there is among the real experts, and the general public gets even more of a misimpression from the secondhand experts. So that 75-25 split begins to look very much like a consensus to the experts. The outliers, if you can tell that there are outliers at all, look like dissidents. Worse than dissidents, they look like crazies. And to the extent that lay people run across outlier opinions, they're likely to see those opinions branded as misinformation. Now, underlying much of what I'm saying here is my view that expert disagreement is normal. It doesn't necessarily mean that one bunch of experts is incompetent or dishonest or biased. It can just mean that the answer isn't firmly known and opinions differ and the data are not dispositive. But most experts, interestingly enough, seem to think like otherwise. When experts are forced to acknowledge that the other side exists at all, which they try not to do, but when they're forced to acknowledge that, yeah, there is another side, they often assert pretty explicitly that the other side is incompetent or dishonest or biased. It's shockingly rare, in my experience, for an expert to matter-of-factly tell the public that other equally qualified experts disagree. When it happens, you notice it. When an expert says, well, this is my opinion, but I have colleagues with the same degrees I have and just reading the same journals I read who think something completely different. Experts don't often say that. Similarly, it was shockingly rare throughout COVID how few mutually respectful debates academia fostered. You would think maybe, at least if you were naive, you might think that academia is a place where experts on debatable issues debate those issues. That certainly did not happen very often with COVID. Now, in fairness, there is a contrary trend. Sometimes experts with minority or even outlier opinions build a reputation on their idiosyncratic positions. There's a niche for an iconoclast expert. I think it's a small niche and a dangerous niche, but I certainly talking to the Heterodox Academy, which is in business in large measure to nurture that contrarian niche. I don't want to imply that it doesn't exist, but I think we probably can all agree that it's for most people unattractive. It's a minority taste to be known as having weird opinions. I should also concede that there's a contrary trend to my argument that expert consensus is often manufactured. As many of you know, sometimes dissensus is manufactured, uncertainty is manufactured. There are often interest groups trying, even if an issue is pretty well settled, trying to persuade the public that it is way more debatable than it actually is. So there is an effort to manufacture consensus on the one hand. There is an effort to manufacture dissensus and uncertainty on the other hand. What that ends up with is the amount of expert disagreement is likely to be more than the majority claims and less than the minority claims. But the majority is getting most of the public attention. So it's the former bias, the understating of expert disagreement, that dominates public opinion and dominates policy formation. Okay, next slide, please. Point three, like a gas, expertise expands to fill the available space. If we let them, all experts will happily opine beyond their expertise. And we usually let them, and we certainly did let them vis-a-vis COVID. This is, a very simple point, and I can make it rather more quickly than I made the first two. When they're talking to other professionals, experts tend to define their expertise very narrowly, deferring to somebody else in the room who is a firsthand expert. But as soon as experts are talking to the general public, where there is no firsthand expert in the room, then experts typically define their expertise much more broadly. As long as I know more about the question than the audience does, I'm likely to feel qualified to opine freely in an interview, in an op-ed, pretty much in any venue I have an opportunity to speak in. That would be all right, I think, if experts were sort of acknowledging that they were out of their lane. It turns out that epidemiologists, for example, and virologists, to take two fields both very directly relevant to COVID, they have quite different expertise. They know a little bit about each other's fields, but not that much. And you know, for the most part, if an epidemiologist starts talking virology, or a virologist starts talking epidemiology, or either talks immunology or industrial hygiene or mathematical modeling or toxicology or any of the other fields that are directly relevant to the sciences involved in COVID, they are out of their lane. But they are unlikely to say so. They are unlikely to recognize that it's true. And they're quite likely to feel justified in expressing opinions, expert opinions, on not just on topics where they're not firsthand experts, but even on topics where they're not secondhand experts, where they're not in their field. And I think maybe that's all I need to say about that. Next slide, please. Point number four, during COVID, we unwisely allowed technical experts to dominate decisions that desperately needed social science expertise. You know, epidemiologists, as I say, often stray into virologists' lane and vice versa, but at least they know there's a lane there that they're straying into. Not so sure social science is a lane at all. Now, I mean, given the replication crisis in social science, I grant that maybe they have a point. But this is, after all, a panel of social scientists, so I feel reasonably safe in asserting that social science is actually a field, or a whole bunch of fields. Psychology is a field, sociology, political science, even communication. These are squishier fields than physics. They're probably even squishier fields than epidemiology and virology, but they are fields. They were not fields well represented in COVID decision making. I made a habit whenever there was an advisory committee or a decision making body of some sort of to study the expertise of the people in the group. And there was usually no social scientist in the group. They were all so-called hard scientists. And that's not because social science questions weren't at stake. And I could list 50, but I will list two fundamental social science questions that, and I want to say the questions weren't ignored. They were answered by amateurs. They were answered by people who had studied no social science since maybe high school history. And I'll name just two questions. Now, number one, of course, mandates increase compliance with pandemic precautions. You know, if you make people do things, they're likelier to do them. But the question, the social science question, is how will the coercion in a mandate affect people's attitudes toward those precautions, their willingness to take them when the mandate ends, their attitude toward the government agencies behind them? Pretty much every social scientist is familiar with the concept of reactance, the tendency of people to get irritated when they are coerced, and that irritation leads to kinds of resistance that are measurable and indeed predictable. But I think COVID decisions about mandates got made by public health people, by non-social scientists who probably never heard of reactants and certainly were not thinking hard about the difference between is it a good idea to get vaccinated and is it a good idea to make people get vaccinated. So that's one. The second one, and again, I could do 20 or 200, but I'm only going to do two. An obvious social science question that was, I think, inadequately considered: how will closing schools for many months affect children? And to what extent will the loss of social interaction in the school, to what extent will the being stuck home with nobody to be with, to talk with, to interact with, to what extent will there be loss of learning? To what, you know, is remote learning gonna do a good job of replacing in-person learning? These are questions to which social scientists have answers. Sometimes debatable answers, but it is a field. They are questions that were answered by hard scientists who knew nothing about that field. So, I mean, two pretty obvious implications of all of this. Number one, COVID outcomes might have been significantly better if social scientists had been consulted more. And number two, epidemiologists and virologists and the rest of the key decision makers of throughout the COVID decision making were unlikely to make optimal social science decisions. It's not that they weren't making social science decisions, they were just making ignorant social science decisions. And I think society paid a price for that. Okay, next slide, please. We're halfway done. I don't know how we're doing on time, but I've done four out of the eight I want to cover. Number five, and it's a related, but I think even bigger problem in some ways, maybe the biggest of the eight I want to talk about. Too often, experts assume that their technical expertise gives them policy expertise as well. But policy questions, I think, are largely values questions. They are in large measure not scientific questions at all. They're trans-scientific. Now, to some extent, of course, policy is a social science. And in that sense, point five is just a restatement of point four. When scientists decide to make policy decisions, they are maybe making social science decisions. But I think it goes beyond that. I mean, I think social science is the study of policy, but it's to actually decide what should we do. I mean, social scientists study what's likely to happen if we do X. The question of should we do X is not just a social science question, it is a values question. I think what's incredible here is that technical experts in public health and in most other fields as well, technical experts not only allied from their expertise to others people's expertise, they not only allied from their expertise to other people's expertise to social science expertise, they allied from all those kinds of expertise to values questions that aren't about expertise at all, that are about ideology, that are about ethics and topics about which none of us has a right to pull rank as an expert. Now, of course, a technical expert's technical opinions, if they follow logically, if they lead logically,
Peter,
to a policy position.
This is your 3-minute warning. Your 3-minute warning.
All right, I got to hurry up. Okay. What's most central here is technical people went to value judgments. They made value judgments. They defended those value judgments routinely as if they were expert opinions. So, if you're trying to decide whether we should give people booster shots or not, and you haven't got good data yet, one of the things you're considering is should we move without good data, or should we wait till we have better data? That's a values question. People are pressing for boosters. So one of the things you're considering is should we give in to pressure, or should we not defer to pressure? That's a values question. So values questions were contaminating. We're dominating a lot of decisions about COVID, but they weren't represented as values questions. They were represented as technical questions. And we could go on and on. The origin of COVID, did it start in an animal market or in a lab? The effectiveness of masks and of mask mandates. What happens with questions like that is if you're on one side, you look at a study and you find that study very persuasive. If you're on the other side, you find the same study full of methodological flaws. So you cherry pick among the studies the ones that support your values. You represent yourself and maybe actually believe that you're standing tall for the data, but what you're actually standing tall for is your prior opinion, is your values. Okay, we're going to have to move on. Next slide, please. Insofar as experts' values are political, They are far likelier to lean left than right. That's partly because academia is mostly a left-leaning enterprise. It's also partly, I think, because public health is mostly a left-leaning enterprise. For reasons that I wish I had time to go into. So public health made lots of decisions that were more upsetting to the right than they were to the left. And I'll list just a few of them. Excoriating anti-lockdown demonstrations as super spreader events, and then giving George Floyd demonstrations against police violence a free pass. Proposing that young people of color were a higher priority target for scarce vaccine doses than elderly white people. Shutting down churches during lockdowns is inessential while keeping liquor stores open. Delaying the vaccine rollout until after Election Day, so at least in part, so Donald Trump couldn't have an October victory lap. Deferring to teachers' unions and decision-making about whether and when to reopen schools. These were all decisions that were not only arguable and arguably not widely trusted, or at least not universally trusted. They were left-leaning decisions that alienated the right far more than the left.
Okay, Peter.
Next slide, please.
Peter, we'll have to stop here so we can move on to the next presentation.
All right, let me just say what number 7 and number 8 are. Number 7 is that the public health prioritizes health over anything else, over economics, education, and even liberty. And number 8 is that public health also prioritizes health over truth. Faced with a choice between telling you the full truth and telling you something that will get you to do what I think is good for your health, most public health people choose, if not actually a lie, if not actually a noble lie, at least a misleading distortion of the full truth in the service of health. Next and last slide, just so you can see them all at once. There they are. Those are, in my judgment, a great deal of what happens in academia all the time, not just with COVID, and certainly what happened vis-a-vis COVID. And I will belatedly stop there.
Thank you, Peter.